Okay, I think we'll get started. I tell my students, that's your clue to start paying attention to me. I'm a little nervous to use this clock or any clock for Fred's talk this morning about getting started on time, especially a session on deep time, but we'll use that as our arbitrary starting point. So tape minister, you can get ahead and roll the tape. My name is Dan Spencer. I teach in the Environmental Studies program at the University of Montana. And this session is the second of three sessions on looking at different aspects of deep time. On Monday night, we looked at deep time in the fullest sense of the story of the universe, about 3.7 billion years, but we think now about that age there. We're going to keep narrowing our focus, or bringing our scope in. So we're going to look at one third of that story, which is the story of the solar system that we belong in, and of the Earth, in that about 4.5, 4.6 billion years, somewhere in that area there. And then in that story of the Earth, we're actually going to be looking mostly at the last 10% of it, the last 500 million years or so, and even less than that. So keep in mind, I always tell my students this, just because I'm narrowing this story down for our sake, doesn't mean there aren't all sorts of interesting parts of the story going on elsewhere. So if you keep in mind there are an estimated 200 or 300 billion galaxies with 200 or 300 billion stars in each one, probably lots and lots of planets. There's stories going on all over the universe. We're just focusing on this one because it's of particular interest to us. I need to start with a bit of a disclaimer. I studied geology a long time ago, in the last millennium, right? So I'm a bit of a petrified geologist at this point here. And there may well be people in the room who have more recent geological knowledge about what I'm going to be talking about today, and I welcome that. So feel free to correct information that's incorrect, or add to it, or deepen it, do on that. But I love geology. It's in some ways my first love. Holden kind of shifted me in a tectonic way when I was here from geology into theology. I came here in 1980 trying to discern which geology graduate school to go to, and as I mentioned, that ended up being Union Theological Seminary. And I thought I was going there for 1 year to get that out of my system and then go back to geology. I never made it back to the formal study of geology, but it still informs my life in a lot of ways. One of the things that was really coming into vogue when I was in seminary was story theology, or how narratives shape who we are. And Fred did a really nice job kind of reminding of that the Bible said this morning. What does it mean to be part of this biblical story, part of this Christian story, shaping our character in that? And geology is a similar thing for me, too. It expands my sense of who I am in the world and the place in the world and how that has come together. And I hope I'll impart some of that to you today. Two other disclaimers, or warnings, or invitations. John Schramm made the quip that my students at the University of Montana get the most words per tuition dollar from my lectures. I tend to get excited, I speak quickly, I have a lot of information. If I'm going too fast or we need to slow down, please just slow me down. I'm happy to do that. And the other thing is more just, I was telling Susan Briel this, and there are some people from 1980 here. 1980 was a really amazing year in geology in the Northwest because it's the year of Mount St. Helens. And so when Mount St. Helens began to become active that spring, people asked me to do a talk on geology of Mount St. Helens and the Cascades. And at that point, I was still a practicing geologist, so I had a suitcase full of geology t-shirts. And what I did was, I called it my geological striptease. I put all my different t-shirts on, and every time I got to an appropriate message, I would peel off another layer and I'd be there. I tried to find those t-shirts, I still have them, but I couldn't find the box. So I have put this is going to be my t-shirt model here when we get to the appropriate point. And geologists are notorious for bad puns. So I'm going to try to compete with Fred, and we'll see who's the least funny. You can judge on that. But we'll go ahead and get started here. Now, if somebody could turn off the light closest to the door. Joel, if you did, yeah, good. And so people still got enough light. I know there are people in the back row doing crafts, which is fine. And I want to make sure people can see this here. So this is a diagram of really the geology of our area. And if we were in this diagram, Holden would be up over in this area here. And I'm going to come back at different points of this here. But anybody know what geological process is being shown here?
Plate tectonics,
all right? Plate tectonics in general. And if you saw the movie, the show the other night, one of the things they talked about is that all of the Earth is in motion, it's flowing, but the crust of the Earth is rigid. However, the crust is broken up into these big plates. It's sort of like the scales on a reptile's back. So they move with respect to each other. Imagine a reptile flexing its back. Those plates are moving back and forth, not inside the plate, but between the plates. And that's what generates a lot of the geology in our area. We actually have, there's two plate boundaries in this diagram here. I'll come back and talk a little bit about here. This is called an oceanic ridge, where hot magma comes up from the mantle and erupts in volcanoes, usually on this ocean floor, and two different pieces of the Earth's crust move away from each other there. It's called a spreading center. And Washington State has one just off of its west coast. Then this plate is coming along here, and it's called an oceanic plate. The volcanic material that comes out of this here forms a heavy basaltic kind of lava, and it's denser than, you see here, it says a continental plate. So they are actually moving towards each other, and because the oceanic plate is denser and heavier, it gets forced down underneath the continental plate. So we have two oceanic plates here that are spreading apart, an oceanic plate here, and a continental plate that are colliding. And those two motions are going to be responsible for pretty much all of the geology that we're going to see here in there. So I'll kind of unpack this a little bit here. But what I'd like to do for today is to give a big picture overview. I'm not going to talk too specifically about the specific geology at Holden in the Railroad Creek Valley, although we can certainly talk about that more when we get there. What I'd like to do is give you the story that's generated the big picture context for that, and so we'll work with that. So you always want to locate yourself, whether it's in theology or geology here, and so here is our relative context, which is the North American continent, which is also, by and large, makes up the North American plate. So one of the things to keep in mind is virtually all of North America functions as one single plate. There are a few exceptions. If you've ever thought Southern California marches to a bit of a different beat than the rest of the country, it does. It's geologically on a different plate. All right? There's a San Andreas Fault that goes through there is a plate boundary. And there, as my partner from San Francisco always reminds me, I grew up in Los Angeles, that I didn't even belong to the North American plate. But one thing I want you to notice is all the different colors up here. This is where we are. Lots and lots of colors means lots of different geological formations, which means it's a complex history. If I lived in Iowa before, beautiful state for agriculture, a little dull for geology. You sort of see it's all the same color there. The last time anything exciting happened in Iowa geologically was about 500 million years ago.
I'll make an exception to that. I think it's very beautiful.
It is beautiful, especially if you're a geomorphologist and you like surficial geology, geology of the surface. What I'm part of our geologist means called superficial geology. I warned you, lots of bad puns. My partner is a plant ecologist and does restoration ecology. He's always trying to get me excited about them. And I say, well, for future fossils, that's a pretty interesting looking plant. It's all about the scale. Iowa does have some wonderful geology. But I love tectonics. I love the kind of the action. And Iowa tectonically has been relatively calm for about a half a billion years.
So that's where you want to live then.
If you want to avoid big earthquakes, Iowa's a good place, and tornadoes, a few other things. But no, we're going to talk about this little line you see right here is the subduction zone that's right off the coast of Washington here, and has it called the transfer to the Cascadia Fault. And we'll talk a little bit about geological hazards that come with the area here. So I'm going to just move us along. You can stop me at any point here. So here's what I would kind of think about. I'm going to go back one step here, just because this is such a beautiful thing. When you have a collision between an oceanic plate and a continental plate, the oceanic plate erupts lava here, and it's doing that under the ocean. And so a lot of water gets taken up inside that lava, so the rock is infused with water. As this plate moves down underneath the continental plate, it gets hotter and hotter. It begins to heat up. What happens when you heat water? It boils. And at a certain depth, the water begins to boil off at this place where it's there and comes into the continental plate, and it begins to melt the rocks in the continental plate. And this forms what we call magma, liquid rock, which then goes up and creates the volcanoes. Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier, Mount Hood, all these there. But the other thing to think about here is the oceanic plate is actually getting destroyed as it goes down, and it's adding mass to the continental plate. So over time, our continents have gotten larger and larger. They have a larger percentage of the Earth's surface, and they continue to grow in size because of that here. And so you'll see that a little bit here. This, what's called the North American Craton, is the old core of the North American plate. And that was, has since been stable for a long time. There's Iowa, right in the middle of it, very stable for a long time. Then you have this edge here that's called deformed craton. This is part of the old continent, but because of plate tectonics, it has been uplifted, folded, things like that. Here's the Rocky Mountains, come right through that. And then you have this interesting thing called the accretionary belt, all along the edge here, and notice that's right where we are. And accretion means what?
Accumulate.
Accumulate. Things are getting smashed onto it there, and that's what makes our geology so complex and so interesting here. You can see a good example here. You've got the islands out in the Caribbean, Cuba, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Jamaica, and so forth. At some point, these may well be pushed onto and stuck to the North American plate. The same way on the western side of the Pacific, you have a whole bunch of different islands there, Japan, the Philippines, Indonesia, so forth. Eventually, those will probably be smushed onto the Asia plate there. And then you'll have a new geological terrain. So this is part of the west coast, again, intuitively, you know the west coast is danced to a very different beat than the rest of the state and the nation, but geologically it does as well, and it makes it a very interesting place to start looking at it. So that's where we're at the home here. We're going to look at how did we, this area, become part of the North American plate, get kind of plastered onto the North American craton. So I'm going to take us back a little bit of time. So again, now we're back into the early Triassic. This is the rise of the first dinosaurs. Keep in mind, this is only 1/20th of the Earth's history. Right? So we saw that beautifully modeled last night in the spiral. Remember how long it took? Was it Laura who was talking?
Laura.
Yeah, Laura, to walk out from the first single cell until you even got multi-cells. It took a long, long time for it. And so we're in the last 5% of the world's history, even when we're talking about 237 million years ago when the dinosaurs ruled. But do you have a question, Mary?
No.
Nope, okay. Tom will have comments on this ignored here. What's that?
Just some awe and wonder going on.
Yeah. Oh, good, okay. I don't like awe and wonder, so. Yeah, there's the... We can stay away from Days of Dust and Ashes when we get to Mount St. Helens. That would be appropriate, but somewhere in here there's an awe of Days of Miracle and Wonder, so we'll focus on that. One of the things to think about is that there have been a few periods in the history of the Earth when all the continents that we know today, which are pretty widely spread out, were actually together in one single continent. And that made a big, big influence here. And so at the beginning of the Triassic, 230 million years or so, we think that there was one supercontinent called Pangaea. And you can see North America up here, but notice the whole western half of North America is missing. It didn't exist yet. So whereas South America, relatively intact, Africa, relatively intact, Australia, relatively intact, here's Antarctica. North America has been pieced together almost, you know, half of it since that time there. If we go forward a little bit, we're now at 152 million years ago. This puts us in the middle of Jurassic, many of you from the Jurassic Park, kind of a height of the dinosaurs here. Notice what's beginning to happen here. North America is beginning to split off from these other continents here. This is the birth of the Atlantic Ocean. We also heard about that in the spiral last night. They begin to spread. Anybody been to New York City and looked across the Hudson there? If you do, on the other side of the Hudson River, the New Jersey shore is what they call the Palisade Sill. It's this big lava flow formation that forms a big up there. That sill dates the opening of the Atlantic Ocean. That was that underwater volcanoes that were erupting as this began to spread apart there. So that's the edge of the plate boundary at that point. There's a similar formation over here in Africa. Anybody's been to Morocco, you'll see some of these on there. So this begins to open up here, and the remnant here was called Gondwana. Gondwana there, which leads me to my first bad t-shirt. Many of us are very concerned about what has happened to Gondwana. So we have a t-shirt calling for reunite Gondwana land, all right? The separatist movements have taken over, and so we can see. Notice the western part of North America now has the Rocky Mountains. We begin to see the uplift of the Rocky Mountains, but still nothing here yet where we are in Washington State. Okay? So we move along here. Now we're in the late Cretaceous period. 95 million years ago, so the Cretaceous ends at 65 million years ago with the collision of an asteroid that leads to the extinction of the dinosaurs and over 60% of all life in that area here. What's happened to North America? The interesting thing about the Cretaceous period is sea levels were much higher for all sorts of complex reasons I can talk about later. Climate change, the oceans were warmer. When the oceans warmed, they expand, sea level came up. And so the whole interior of the North American continent became a vast inland sea. So if you go over to eastern part of Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, you have all these fossil formations. That's where maybe been a dinosaur national monument, things like that. This is all for you. But notice also, now what's happening off the coast of North America. It's hard to see from where you are, but there's a whole bunch of islands forming off there. And these are the islands that are eventually going to get accreted onto North America and become the rocks of where we are right here in the Holden area. Now, one of the interesting things, too, is notice this is labeled India. And it's way south of the ocean here. India is going to take off, like just really, really move fast and going to start moving north, and it's going to run into China. And what's the result? The Himalayas, the highest mountain range that we have here. In particular, because India is a continental plate, so is there. So when you get a collision of continental plates, you can't have one going underneath the other one. It's sort of like if you've ever had a kickboard out in the water, and what happens when you try to push it down and stand on it? Just comes popping back up. So you push two together, one try to force one in the other, it won't happen. Instead, they buckle upwards into mountains. So that's another form of mountain range there. So this is going to be kind of where the continents are beginning to take their shape, although a lot of them are submerged in their lowest parts because sea level is so much higher.
Tom, when you say India moves fast, I mean, it's not like a couple weeks.
No. it's opposed to maybe 1 or 2 inches a year, might have been moving at 5 inches a year. You know? And that's a lot for the surface to be moving there. And it's sort of, yeah, so when I'm speaking geologically in that time there. So it picks up fast for a plate. Wouldn't be something we'd notice. The plates, most plates move about the same speed as your fingernail grows. So if you don't clip your fingernails for a year, it might be out 1 to 2 inches, 1.5 inches in that area. That's about that is moving there. But they got a lot of time to play with and work with, and that those stresses build up, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. So we're getting closer to our immediate context here, and I wanted to just give you some of the geography that we're gonna be talking about here. So here's the Puget Sound area. And we are up in this Lake Chelan Valley right up in here. We're up in the North Cascades. We'll also look at some of the volcanoes, Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, Mount St. Helens, Mount Hood. You've got the Olympic Range out here. And then you have this vast area of eastern Washington, all covered with basalt flows. If any of you have driven Highway 2 across there, you'll get across that there. And also these big dry river ravines and stuff in there. So we'll take a look at each of these and see sort of how they fit together in the geological mosaic here. So we talked about this already. Plate tectonics is our big context. For me, I started studying geology in the early 70s, and it was a very exciting time to study geology because plate tectonics was a brand new paradigm. And at my college, I went to Carleton College, the other Northfield school, and half of my faculty were older and didn't accept plate tectonics, and half the faculty were younger and just came out of graduate school, and they were all hot to trot with plate tectonics. So it was so I was sort of raised in the first generation of students taught plate tectonics. But all these little lines out in the ocean, these are all you see as those spreading zones where new continental or new ocean crust is being created and they're moving out. And then the continents are basically riding on top of this. And in some places, there are collision there. All along the Pacific coast of North and South America is a collision zone. Not coincidentally, this is where we find most earthquakes and most volcanoes, because that subduction process is happening there. The Atlantic of these two countries is relatively calm geologically, because the plate boundary is actually out in the middle of the ocean. So they're all riding together up there, not a lot happening geologically there. Although when it does happen, it's big.
Dan, what are these lines made of?
So what they actually are rift zones. So this is where you have the ocean is breaking apart. And because the mantle underneath is fluid and it's hot, the heat rises, and as it gets to there, it pulls these apart here. One of the best analogies, if you can model this in your own kitchen, if you want to choose. A great example here is if you're making hot chocolate sometime, right? Make hot chocolate in a pan, or make pea soup in a pot, and let it cool a little bit. And what happens to the surface of it? It crusts over, right? It crusts over. And then if you turn the heat back on again, you're going to get bubbles and water rising up there, and oftentimes it'll take that crust and push it to the side of the pot there. That's virtually the same kind of process is happening with these plates here. So all along the bottom there, there's magma coming up, and it gets to the surface and it begins to move out, and it carries, splits these apart here. These are the longest mountain chains in the world. All these little lines are actually mountain chains, but they're volcanoes. So they're undersea volcanoes. So the vast majority of the world's volcanoes we don't see because they're underwater. There are a few places where this actually gets above sea level. One of them is Iceland. And if you've been to Iceland or know about Iceland, it's all volcanic, and it's a place where that spreading center has actually gotten above sea level. But most places it's below sea level.
What causes the spreading center?
What causes spreading center? The short story of it is that the center of the Earth is much, much hotter than the surface. And if you have a temperature differential between two areas there, the heat will migrate towards the colder area. So the heat's migrating from the hotter core of the Earth, migrating out. As it gets out there, it tends to come up in what are called convection currents. You can see this if you boil water in a clear glass. It'll come up and it'll move, create sort of circles like this. And so it's both pulling these apart and then dragging them down when it gets over to here. And that's the sort of our big plate tectonic context for there. So we're again up in here, and what's really interesting is notice what's happened here. You have this mid-oceanic ridge out here, and all of a sudden it disappears under North America. And it pops out again right here for a little bit, and then it disappears up by Alaska there. What's happened is that the North American plate has actually moved so far to the west, it's overrun this spreading center. And it creates all sorts of interesting geology as a result of that. One of them is the San Andreas Fault. San Andreas Fault in California is where the plates are sliding past each other there. And then it's also up here in the north, we have just this little bit of spreading center still left up here, the Juan de Fuca plate. And that creates the subduction that has created our Cascade Range. So if you're familiar with the volcanoes, they start basically with Mount Lassen in Northern California. They end at Mount Garibaldi in Southern British Columbia, but mostly Washington and Oregon have these high volcanoes. And that corresponds exactly with where this plate is still out, is spreading there, and the plate's being pushed down underneath there. In a few more million years, we'll override that, and there'll probably be no more volcanoes here.
And so the big one, I don't know if you're going to talk about that later, but if that's supposedly within 500 years, what is that?
So I will talk about the big one we get there, because the Cascadia Fault is geologically really exciting, and socioeconomically, also really exciting, but for different reasons.
Why isn't there anything in the way of lines around Hawaii?
Okay, so very good question. There are a few other places on the Earth that's what geologists call hot spots. So Hawaii is one of them, and there seems to be independent plumes of lava coming up from the mantle there. And Hawaii is actually right in the middle of the Pacific Plate. That Pacific plate is still moving, so you have a stationary plume of lava coming out, and you have a plate moving over it, and it creates a series of islands. And so Hawaii is the youngest island, and as you move out to the northwest, they get older and older. There's actually a new island forming to the southeast of Hawaii. There's a volcano that's erupting in there, it just hasn't reached the surface yet. No, so this isn't the problem with geology. The delight of geology is it just spins more and more questions here. I mentioned that one of the interesting things about North America is we've overrun this spreading center ridge, and that's created interesting geology. We also seem to have overrun a hotspot. So if you imagine if the continent got all the way over to Hawaii and then ran over the top of Hawaii, what would happen? And it's created a mega volcano. It's one of the largest volcanoes on the planet. Anybody know which one I'm talking about?
This is Yellowstone National Park.
Right? Yellowstone National Park is a very, very large volcano, 45 miles across. Most of us don't even think it was a volcano because it had the similar shape, but it seems to be a hotspot, and you can trace its path all the way across southern Idaho until you get there with a series of eruptions. So when we get back to that, I'll talk a little bit more. It's technically a little outside of our region here, but it's really, really interesting. So I hope that's sort of the big picture of stuff. Any questions at all on this before I move us along? As I say, we're going to be looking at geological rates here. Okay, so here's what I mentioned before. This is just a little bit more diagram of it here. So this is the Juan de Fuca Plate is this spreading between two ocean ridges that's right off the coast of Oregon and Washington right here. And it's moving relatively to the east, and the North American Plate is moving relatively to the west. A couple different things begin to happen here. As I mentioned before, these basalt flows erupt underwater, and so they get a lot of water in the lava. As they move down, that water begins to boil off. It actually melts the rock up above it there and creates these magma chambers here. And this creates what we call igneous rocks. Igneous rocks are the oldest rocks because they originally were liquid here. Brings me to one of my next, I wish I had this t-shirt here, but every geologist knows that igneous is bliss. I studied volcanoes in the Cascades there. But this creates our whole chain of volcanoes. And you'll notice this line here with the teeth on it, that's called the trench. That's the actual place where the plates are meeting. So everything on this side is the Juan de Fuca Plate, everything on this side is the North American Plate. But notice there's a gap. It's a gap about 40 to 50 miles between the plate boundary and where the volcanoes pop up. Why do you think that is? Why is there a gap there?
It has to go low enough to heat up.
Exactly. You have to get deep enough down here when you reach heat and pressure that the water starts boiling up here. And so one of the really interesting things that geologists have been able to reconstruct is that the angle that these plates go down varies all around the world. So if you go to South America, the Andes crust is much closer to the ocean than it is in North America. Because the plates seem to be going down at a steeper angle, so it does not as far inland, but it begins to melt on that. You can sort of, the same thing happens with the earthquakes here. So you create this whole series of volcanoes. You also get a series of earthquakes here, and that's what it creates our context here. So again, what is this process called when you put one plate beneath another one?
Subduction,
okay? And you can see this is called the Cascadia subduction zone. And what happens to the continental margin when you have subduction going on?
It's narrowing,
yep. And what happens to the formerly relatively level edge of the continent? It gets pushed up into mountains, okay? And so this leads me, and this is actually my favorite t-shirt that I did here. We call this subduction leads to orogeny. Now hold up your seats. You know what subduction is? What's orogeny?
Uplift.
It is. It's uplift. It's the geological term for mountain building. Right? So we live in an orogenic zone here. Orogeny there. Subduction leads to orogeny. And so you can see this coming down here. The result is the mountains there. And then with enough time, orogeny leads to relief. We just call this topographic relief, is what you get here. And that's what we're sitting in there. We're talking about all this topographic relief that's created by subduction leading to orogeny, this notion here.
Geologists can't spell, is that what you're saying?
Did I misspell it?
Oh, you're right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very easy to misspell this stuff because you forget what's the pun and what's the original. But the point is that I hope you'll remember some of these. These are these little mnemonic devices to help you remember the actual geological processes there. So this is our immediate context that we're doing. And now I want to begin to sort of move into some of the more details here. Diane asked about the Cascadia earthquakes. We live in a geologically very, very active area here. And one of the things that's actually pretty puzzling is that there have been large earthquakes to the south of us, particularly you think of San Andreas Fault and the regular size of earthquakes, and large earthquakes to the north of us, the Alaska earthquake in the 1960s, a good example here. But we haven't had very many big earthquakes in this immediate area for a while. Why not? The plate's still moving.
Stuck.
That's what these geologists think. The plates don't have an even movement. They move more like, they build up stress, and then that stress is like a mousetrap. It suddenly releases, and you have all this release of energy. And what geologists have found, people used to just in Seattle and Portland be kind of smug about people who lived in LA and San Francisco, like, you guys have that San Andreas Fault. Well, San Andreas Fault's pretty mild in terms of compared to the Cascadia Fault. And what we now have some pretty good evidence is that the largest earthquakes that we've measured have been in the high eights on the Richter scale. But there's evidence that the Cascadia Fault has produced 9-point earthquakes. And one of the things you remember is that the Richter scale that we use, you know, here a 6.4 earthquake or a 7.2 earthquake, that's a logarithmic scale. So a 7-point earthquake is 10 times as strong as a 6-point earthquake. And an 8-point earthquake is 10 times as strong as a 7-point earthquake. And a 9 is 10 times as strong as an 8. And so a 7-point earthquake can be really, really devastating. A 9-point earthquake can be 100 times as strong, can be really challenging here. And so, understatement, right? So we used to always call San Francisco the city that waits to die. Wait till I'm done with Tacoma. We're going to have so many interesting geological hazards in this area here just to be thinking about on that. But this is our, so you've got the subduction zone, and you have different level faults here. You've got very deep faults that happen right along the plate boundary that lists them 1949, 1965, 2001. And then the crustal faults are where you get the higher or closer to the surface on that. And so, what we're seeing is that the source in the subduction zone seems to happen about a 500 to 600 year cycle. And this is when the whole plate itself slips. And these are big earthquakes. And there's some fascinating things about that. What I'll talk about is a little bit when we get to tsunamis and the problem with geological hazards. There are legends on Vancouver Island among the native peoples there of entire villages that simply disappeared into the ocean. And there's actually a really interesting stuff. Some of you read there was a great article about this in the New Yorker this last year. You've read it here. Really wonderful. You can find it online. It's worth reading. There was a village in Japan in the 1600s that suddenly disappeared from a huge wave that seemed to have come out from nowhere. Well, what we're pretty sure now is that was an earthquake generated on the Cascadia Fault. It created a tsunami that crossed the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean and then hit Japan with enough force to eliminate several fishing villages there. Wow. And one other little detail here, it's sometimes hard to, it was very hard for me to understand the size of the Pacific Ocean until I was on a boat that crossed it. And I 5 years ago, I was teaching for a program called Semester at Sea. And I was on a ship for 4 months and we literally circled the globe. It took us 6 days to get across the Atlantic. It took us 19 days to get across the ocean, I mean, the Pacific. The Pacific is a really big ocean. So imagine a tsunami traveling the entire length of that and hitting Japan with enough force to eliminate these fishing villages.
Hey, Dan, yeah. How do they measure those deep earthquakes? Or what do they use?
So this is where the whole field of seismology comes in. Earthquakes, when they happen, generate these vibrations, the earth there. And they do two different kinds of waves. I'm not going to get into the details too much, but these vibrations then travel through the earth. And geologists set up seismographs to sense them all around the earth. And they're constantly sensing them. There's earthquakes happening all the time. Most of them are pretty minor. And there's a couple, the earthquake waves travel differently through solid material than they do when they hit liquid. So we have a liquid core. So if the, when it goes there, they refract in different ways. They bounce off those surface boundaries. And so if you measure these waves, these vibrations at several different points on the surface of the Earth, you can get a sense of both where it happened and the relative strength, the size of it there. Yeah. And so we now have these measuring seismograph stations all over the planet. And so we get really, really good data very quickly from that. Okay. So this is the big context here. Now I'm going to take us back to history a little bit. So we understand the framework, and this same kind of geological processes have been operating for hundreds of millions of years here. So again, we're back into the late Jurassic, or into the early Jurassic period, about 175 million years ago. You have this big inland sea beginning to form that will eventually become the Cretaceous. Here's the new Rocky Mountains starting to come up. So I live right here in western Montana. But most of this area here is still ocean, and it's got all these different islands here. These are what are called island arcs. They are the islands that form when volcanoes erupt out in the ocean near a continent. So the best analogy today is this is what's happening all along the Pacific coast of Asia. If you've been to Japan, Mount Fuji, all a volcanic island. Philippines, all volcanic islands. Indonesia, all these islands are forming out here because there's active subduction going on here, the continent's behind there. So eventually, this all these different pieces here are going to get plastered on to the west coast here. And some of this gets really puzzling because some of these travel a long way. So there is a piece of Alaska, British Columbia, that comes down a little bit towards Washington called Wrangellia. There's geologists call it Wrangellia. If you've been at the Wrangell, the St. Elias Wrangell Mountains, up that area there. So many of the fossils that are found in those rocks there formed at the equator. Right? So they travel from the equator to get that far north there. And this, of course, has created a terrible political situation for all these former islands that were all independent, and now they've been crushed onto this imperialistic big craton, this continent here. So those of us who are concerned about that are insisting on home rule for Wrangellia. So as I say, geologists have a lot of time on the fields, so we think of terrible kinds of things around the campfire. But basically, our whole area here is just, it's like a mosaic that's been crushed together all these formerly independent islands, some of which formed off the coast, or some of which came from thousands of miles away in there. And then you can imagine a field geologist trying to make sense of this. You know, when you're out in here, apologies to the islands again, but when you're out in here, you have a pretty good sense that the rocks you see there formed there, right? At least if they're less than a billion years old. Any rocks you see there, so if you've been to Taylor's Falls in Minnesota, you see the lava flows there, you see the coralline, some of those things, they all pretty much formed there. You can't make that guess out in the west here. You have no idea, it's just really hard to reconstruct where they formed. And geologists have all sorts of ways to try to do that I can talk further about, but just keep that in mind. It's gonna make this much more complex on that here. So here's a cross-section of where we are, and you can sort of see some of the different actions. We've got subduction going on here, the Pacific Ocean plate, magma coming up from the mantle, forming this new basalt here, and getting deep enough here that it begins to form volcanoes. This one shows Mount Baker, but same for Mount Rainier, Mount Hood, any of those here. And then this part in here gets really complicated. That's where we are in the North Cascades. Because this part here is featuring all sorts of different geologic processes going on. There's a wonderful cross section of the Holden Mine that's right outside the BC as you're going your way out there. If anybody's looking, you can see all the rocks. What orientation are they? Almost vertical, right? They're really, really steep. But anybody know what kind of rock types they talk about in there? Everybody remembers. There's amphibolite, that's a metamorphic rock. There's marble. That's an interesting one. What's marble?
It's
metamorphic.
Pardon? It's metamorphic.
It is metamorphic. And what's it made up of?
Calcium
carbonate, all right? And so where does that calcium carbonate come from?
Ocean.
And usually it means that rock used to be limestone. That's a sedimentary rock. That's where you get calcium carbonate. So here's an example. So it gives us a pretty good sense that at least some of the rocks around here used to be sediments. Okay, so you'll see marble, you'll see quartzite. Quartzite was made of quartz, probably was a quartz sandstone before. So we've got some hints about what used to be here. So those were rocks that at one point were just lying down vertically, horizontally, minding their own business. They get caught up in this plate tectonic zone there. They get pushed up, and they also tend to get heated and folded. So the rocks like gneiss or schist or amphibolite, those are rocks that have gotten so heated that the original minerals have reconstituted, and it's very hard to tell what those original parent rocks are. But studying the chemistry, we see some of those were lava flows. So we had sediments like limestone and sandstone, we had lava flows, but they're all mishmashed together. What the nice little term, they just call it the crystalline core. So that's a nice term for really messed up. Really hard to reconstruct. And that's what makes the geology of Holden so challenging sometimes. Yeah.
That's why I think it was really interesting. I got to go through a lot of the core samples that we this week, and there were so many different colors.
There are. It's the mineralogy is so complex, and then that forms the basis in there. And then where the minerals tend to come from is when magmas come in, they generate a lot of hot waters and stuff. Those waters move through the fractures in the rock there, and as they cool, they precipitate out and they deposit different minerals. So that's where the ore body, I encourage you all to take a look at that when you go to the Village Center next time. You'll see the ore body is a fairly narrow row, but it's got magma dikes and things coming into these lava flow formations on that. So that's kind of a cross-section of where we are. And then the whole thing comes to being faulting and uplift, that is cross-section of the North Cascades, and I just put a complicated geology. I mean, you've got all sorts of faults. A lot of these things have moved with respect to their back and forth. They've all been folded. And one of these bad puns here, I think, and the relief one here. It's hard to see this a little bit, but originally these were all flat-lying sediments or lying horizontal. That's the way they get deposited by water. And then as this begins to get contracted and compressed there, they initially get folded. You get these beautiful big folds, and those folds eventually, you imagine it kind of fold like this, eventually the force is so much they begin to break and they begin to fault. So you get faults and breaks and folds in there. And then geologists come around and try to sort this all out. And you imagine now, not only having that going on, but each of these might be a different piece that came from a different part of the ocean there. So the geological story is really complex in this area here. Okay, so just a few things now. So we talked again about the origin of the volcanoes here, and you can see them. I spent the summer of 1980 working on the Medicine Lake volcano and the Newberry volcano too there, and that was the summer that Mount St. Helens was erupting, so I got a chance to go there both before and after the big eruption. Really, really interesting in that. But again, from Lassen Peak in the south to Mount Garibaldi in the north, it corresponds almost exactly with the subduction zone that's coming from the collision of these different plates here. So, one of the things we get in our area here is one of the geology books, and this is called Fire and Ice. These volcanoes are high enough that they support glaciers, at least for now, so they're disappearing. But they also have these explosive histories here. So there's the iconic view of Mount Glacier Peak near from Image Lake. And it's really fascinating when Tom Witt and I, some of our friends, hiked to a place called Ice Lakes, which is just a couple valleys to the south of us here. And I was so struck when we got there. Tom, do you have a chance to remember what's all around there? There's pumice. You're up in all these metamorphic rocks, and all around Ice Lakes, there's pumice. Pumice is the frothy volcanic material that comes from really intensive volcanic explosions. Well, it was covered from glacier. That pumice is from Glacier Peak, from one of its eruptions there. And it's an eruption. One of the things geologists are always trying to figure out the time frame on that. This pumice is sitting on top of rocks that were glaciated, which means that it erupted since the glaciers were there. The glaciers were there not all that long ago. Glaciers have receded, and the pumice is now sitting on top of that. So we know these Glacier Peak eruptions are pretty recent. Here's the eruption of Mount St. Helens. An even more explosive eruption took care of what we now call Mount Mazama, which is now a great crater lake. This is called a caldera, where all the magma empties out, and you create a basin in there. Deepest lake in North America, sixth deepest lake in the world. And the other thing is we have, there are Native American and Indian legends that record this, that these are recorded. Same thing when we get to the catastrophic flood. So we clearly had eyewitnesses, and this became part of the stories there. So we can focus easily on the destructive aspects of volcanoes, but they also create incredibly fertile soils. And so if you've enjoyed the Pacific Northwest wines or different things here, it comes a lot from the soils. In that area there. Then the other one here, and this is a much more recent, well, actually the volcanoes are the most recent. We're just talking the last few million years that they've been here. But the other thing is, so if you've driven across either northeastern Oregon or southeastern Washington and a little bit of Idaho, just covered, kind of geologically monotonous almost, just these miles and miles of these dark lava flow, basaltic lava flows are pretty much all horizontal. Sometimes they have the columnar jointing in them there. These come from the Columbia River basalts, and there's still a lot of debate still about where they came from. About 17 to 20 million years ago, we just got these huge, what are called flood basalts, because they came out of these fissures and just went over the land like floods would do. We see these in several different places around the world, and India has them, and Siberia has them. They're sometimes correlated with significant climate change, because when you get these massive extrusions of basalt like that, it also brings a lot of carbon dioxide and other minerals out, and it actually can change the temperature of the Earth fairly significantly. We don't really know what's happened. One of the hypotheses I've seen about this one here is this was an area that was struck by a fairly large meteorite or asteroid, and when it came in, it just indented and damaged the Earth enough that it kind of released basaltic pressure from below. But this is still kind of speculation. There may be somebody in the room who has more recent information. I don't know, Travis, if you've come across any of this here, but really, really interesting. And it also has just shaped an enormous part of the area that we're in, these river basalts here. This is also a stream of volcanic eruptions that comes from the southwest and the northeast and stops right here. And this is what? This is that Wyoming area. This is Yellowstone. And this traces the migration of this hot spot that's leading out that as the North American plate just kept moving over it. So notice the interesting thing about this here, if hot spots are relatively fixed in place, what direction was the plate moving? Or what direction is the plate moving? It's moving to the southwest. So North America is moving to the southwest, at least relative to this hot spot. And it traces here. Anybody remember what direction the Pacific plate is moving? To the northwest, because we see the Hawaiian Islands stretched out that way. So notice that you've got two different movements there, and yet the North American plate's moving faster than the Pacific plate, so it's colliding with it, it's overriding it. But this is part of what geologists try to do, is to kind of sort out all these different dimensions here. And I love tectonics, because I love the big picture stuff, and it's like, don't bother with all the little details that you're going to muck up in the picture, but we call this arm-waving geology. There's stuff on there. So one of the fascinating stories here, Joel and I were talking about this the other night here, is Glacial Lake Missoula, where I live right now here. We have this fascinating thing that this whole area it reaches the edge of the continental glacier that covered almost all of Canada and reached down into northern. And this is one of the places Iowa gets some fun geology, because the Des Moines Lobe reaches as far south as Des Moines and the Wisconsin glaciation here. But this is, Seattle would have been covered up by this here, where we are right up here, and then right on the edge of this here. And then you have all this bizarre topography in eastern Washington with these deep, deep canyons that look like they've been carved by river, but it's a desert. There's no water running in them there. And so I'll come back and talk a little bit more about this story, but because it's a really fun story about how this came about. But what we now think happened was that as the ice moves south, actually I have this little pointer, which has a red light that I can't see, but you might be able to. Is that on?
Yes.
Okay, there. So when the ice came down here, it actually came across the valley that was draining. This is the Clark Fork River, one of the major tributaries in Missouri, of the Columbia River. And as it came across here, it blocked it up, and it created a huge glacial lake. It doesn't look that big area-wise, although it's several hundred miles long, but it's very deep, 2,000 feet deep. So much, much deeper than like our Great Lakes there. And then I'll talk about it. Periodically, this dam would break. And then when it would break, the water come rushing out, and it had to get into the Columbia River this year. So it came rushing all across eastern Washington, carving these huge canyons there, carving the Columbia River Gorge, backflowing all the way up to a pass where Eugene, Oregon is today, in the Willamette Valley, and eventually rushing out to the sea. And we think this happened about 50 to 55 times. over a several thousand year period here. So that's been some of the most recent ones. So glaciation led indirectly to some of that, but it also has shaped our mountains right around here. So there's a couple different kinds of glaciation. I talked about that's continental scale. What's been most important for us here is what we call alpine glaciation. These are the glaciers that form in the mountains. And this is actually taken up in Alaska, British Columbia area there, so where you still have a lot of alpine features there. But typically you get glaciers that fill the river valleys, and you get these actual rivers of ice, and they are carving down. And so rivers tend to form what we call V-shaped valleys. A water will form right on the base, and it keeps cutting down, and you get a V-shaped valley. Glaciers come in and they turn into a U-shaped valley. The weight of the glacier is such that it really cuts down on the sides here. So when the glacier recedes, you'll have a U-shaped valley with very, very steep sides there. And we have some really good examples. So these are different, I'm not going to get too worried about this here, but you have, one of the things you have oftentimes is that the glacier in the main valley has a lot more ice than the glaciers in the side valleys, so it's cutting down faster. And what happens when the ice recedes then, you have a lot of what are called hanging valleys. Valleys that also had glaciers in them, there were smaller glaciers, and so now they'll oftentimes be up above the main valley, and you oftentimes will have a waterfall or a cascade there. We have some very good examples right here at Holden. Anybody?
Holden Lake.
Really good. Copper Basin is a good example. These different valleys, these side valleys that are left up higher now than that, they oftentimes have lakes in them. These lakes are called tarns. You have a little glacier up there that was carving a basin out, then it melts off and it leaves a lake behind it there. So lots and lots of different things that we can sort of see some of the evidence here. And I just put some examples of some local ones here. Lake Chelan is essentially an inland fjord. A fjord is a place where a glacier has charged a deep valley that then when sea level comes up, it gets flooded by the ocean there. We're above sea level here, but we've covered such a deep valley. Anybody know what the lowest spot in Lake Chelan is?
300 below sea level.
Yeah, 300 feet below sea level. So it's as long as it remains below sea level, it's not going to drain to the sea. Right? So it's trapped in land and fills with water. So that's a good example there. Here are some examples of a tarn over there. And these Cirque glaciers are still in place up there. The upper picture there, that's the Hanging Valley of Holden Lake. There were bananas in the background. So you'll see we still have... There it is. Okay, so here's a remnant glacier, Mary Green Glacier, the Estella Glacier. These glaciers are still, for now, melting quickly, but they're still up there on Bonanza. And then here's Holden Lake, which is a tarn there. And here's the bed where it drops off in the main valley, the hanging part of that here. So these glacial features, there's some of what makes it so stunning to be in this area here, because they open up these broad valleys with very, very steep mountainsides on them. And that.
What's the definition of a tarn?
So a tarn is simply a lake that is left in a what's called a cirque. And a cirque is a, go back here, a cirque is a basin, usually they're on the north sides of mountains in the northern hemisphere because they're carved by mountain glaciers up there. And so Lyman Lakes is a good example. You have the Lyman Glacier there. Holden Lake is a good example of the glaciers above there. And then because the glaciers are carving down, it oftentimes will reach a more resistant level at the outlet of the valley before it flows down, so it carves out a little basin, and then when the ice recedes, then a lake forms in that. And it's very typical of glacial areas here. I just say one other thing, I had to catch myself, and constantly remind myself that this is what I'm saying is true of the northern hemisphere. The first time I went to Chile, and I was down in Patagonia, it's just so confused because all the glaciers on the volcanoes are on the south sides of the volcanoes. And everybody knows the glaciers on the north side, but that's true. The northern hemisphere, it's the complete opposite of the southern hemisphere there because of the shading on there. So these are just different glacial features here that we see a lot in this area. So a few more things, and I'm going to move as long because I finish on time. But so here's Glacial Lake Missoula. These catastrophic floods have reshaped eastern Washington, Oregon here. So you had this dam. Here's Missoula. It's the intersection of Carp River and the Bitterroot River. This river continued for over 100 miles, lay for over 100 miles upstream to get the Drummond Valley here. If any of you know, this is now Flathead Lake up in here, if you remember that. But this ice dam, it was a lobe that kept coming down, a lobe of ice, and it cut across there, and it was a couple thousand feet high, which meant that when it blocked the river, that lake would raise up to almost a couple thousand feet above the valley floor. But what do you know about ice and water?
Ice flows.
Ice is more buoyant. And so what began to happen is, as the water built up and built up, it put more and more pressure on the ice that's forming that ice dam till it reached a sufficient point that the ice could no longer hold it. It was trying to float up above it. It was starting to float a little bit, and then the pressure was so much the ice dam would shatter. And then you had an incredible flooding, and it would come down. Here's the valley of the Clarkford River, and then it would hit this whole eastern part of Washington, which originally was just flat. It was all lava flows. There weren't any canyons and stuff at all out there. But it hit there, and these are called the channeled scablands. It just carved all these big river channels until it got concentrated down here at the mouth of the Columbia River Gorge. Then it came roaring through the gorge, eventually out to here, but it was roaring so much that it backfilled the whole Willamette Valley. Part of why the Willamette Valley has really good soil is because it brought a lot of the glacial outwash and stuff along with it there. That combined with the volcanic ash, there's a lot of things here. But it's kind of hard to, let me see if I got this here. One thing to keep in mind is geologists estimate that when the ice dam was flowing out there, the volume of water was 10 times the amount of all the river's waters today. And it took about 3 days to drain. So if you put the Amazon, the Congo, all of our rivers today, 10 times that volume was draining in 3 days there. And this happened 50 or 60 times, we think. It took about 50 to 55 years, we think, to kind of because once it broke, the ice flow was still coming down from Canada. So that lobe would kind of eventually cross out and close that valley up again. The lake would start slowly filling up again. But it took 40 or 50 years for it to reach a point where it was sufficient to break the dam. The whole thing repeat itself. Again, there are Native American legends that talk about something, these stories that seem to very, very possible. This happened 15 to 17,000 years ago, which coincides with roughly when, there's still a lot of debate about when the first folks from Asia got over here. Some people say 13,000, some people say 23,000, a lot of debate. But we have these legends that record some of these events here, which for me is part of the evidence for an earlier date. That there actually were people witnessing this. I mean, could you imagine being out in your canoe? And so Joel and I were talking about this because the fellow who put this together was a fellow named J. Harlan Bretz. And he was a good field geologist in Montana and Idaho and Eastern Oregon. He kept seeing these features that he couldn't explain. So this is the University of Montana. This is Old Main. What do you notice on the hillside behind it? All those layers, all those things. Those are old lakeshore beds, those are beaches. When you have a lake there and the wind action is going back on the water, it's called a strand line. It will create these there. And you can count them, there's over 50 of them there going up to there's an M that's above there, but on these various different heights in there, and so he's going, why are these beach lines way up on the mountainside? There's another place about 100 miles north west of Missoula, and I went there as a geology student the first time in 1978, where when you're down in the valley, you can't really see us, but you get up on the valley shore, and it looks like there's these big, giant ripple marks. Maybe you've been on a little coast, a lake shore and a stream, ripple marks are usually an inch or so across here. This is a cross-country trucker. Yeah. In some sense, these ripple marks are 200 feet across in there. So Bress is saying you'd have to have a huge volume of water to create these. We couldn't figure out what was going on. There's several different pieces of evidence along here. The other one is he's out there looking at eastern Washington. You've got these gorges that have to have been carved somehow, and they're on a desert. There's no water. And so then some of you went to Dry Falls State Park, explains that there's some places we still have some water coming in, like at Palouse Falls here. And then you get further downstream, and you've got the Columbia River Gorge itself, which is this very deep gorge. Now, right now it's challenging to see the power of the Columbia River because most of it's dammed, and so it's mostly lakes like this now here, but nonetheless, we have this deep gorge. And so Bretz was the first one to put this together and propose there had to be catastrophic flooding. But he had two problems. I was talking with Joel about this here. He didn't have a source for the water originally, and the other thing, he had a really bad sense of timing. He was doing this in the 1920s, 19-teens and 1920s, which was during the period of the Scopes Monkey Trial. As geologists for about 300 years had invoked Noah's flood as the main source of our geological change. And they now moved beyond that. We had an older Earth, people weren't using Noah's flood. But the fundamentalists, they love Noah's flood. So if you follow creation science, they will always invoke the flood on there. So he's invoking a flood of biblical proportions to explain this here, and his geology, his colleagues just laughed at him. They said, we're not going there. And so it took another 40 or 50 years until another evidence where they began to understand the role of the ice flow, the lake and so forth. Unfortunately, he was still alive when it finally was accepted on this, because he fought much of his life. And so I always remind my students that science is always a social practice. It takes place in a cultural context, which may or may not make it people receptive to that. Okay, the last thing, here's just an example. This is a, what we call an erratic. This is a piece of rock that's only found up in Montana, that is called the Belt Sediments Rock. In the Mini Glacier National Park, this rock there. It's sitting in the Willamette Valley near McMinnville, 50 or 60 miles south of Portland. There's all sorts of examples of all over the Nickel. And people, geologists have known these for a long time. And the question is, how in the world did they get there? What they think now is that these rocks were embedded in the glacial ice. And when the river broke, when the lake broke, it carried all these icebergs down with these big rocks in them. Those icebergs went floating way up the Willamette Valley, and then as the water level dropped, the icebergs came down and the rocks melted out of them. So it's, again, another piece of the story. But you have to, you're putting this, Eugene, Oregon is hundreds and hundreds of miles away from Missoula. You're going all over the west, trying to piece each different piece of the puzzle together on that. All right, last thing I say, we heard a great talk last night about the hold in mind, and somebody say, keep in mind that this is part of the geologic story now. We've really altered this kind of thing, and the tailings are left behind. There'll be a sedimentary deposit. So our very recent history is also, it's not only social history, it's geologic history, part of our valley here. And the remediation as well is part of that here. So in geological terms, we've got a significant event here. The last thing I wanted to mention, if you'll give me about five more minutes here, is so we talked about geological hazards. And I want to start with both geological hazards, but also geological blessings. We often have to focus on the hazards, and they're very real. So earthquakes are the big one. We've talked about it before. This here is a whole bunch of earthquakes that have taken place in Northern California. A whole bunch of earthquakes off Vancouver Island. But what do you see in that stretch here? Almost no earthquakes. Right? And this is true for at least the last 400 or 500 years. That plate is still moving at a fairly rapid rate down there. And so geologists think it's locked. It's the friction is such that it's there, but the pressure is still building up. So the concern in the Cascadia Fault is that when it breaks, when it finally moves from here to here and it slips, it will generate a really, really large earthquake here. So deep concern about that. The earthquake itself, this one here says, do you remember the Christmas earthquake that produced a tsunami in 2004 that killed 200,000 people? That's about the scale of the earthquake they're anticipating on the Cascadia Fault when it goes here. So the earthquake itself will be a big problem, but also with tsunamis. And this took a long time to recognize there that actually the Puget Sound is a really dangerous area for tsunamis, in part because when the water comes in, it gets concentrated, it goes through a bottleneck here, and it gets concentrated. When you concentrate water, it makes it higher. So people started digging into all the sediments around the Puget Sound, and they found evidence of lots and lots of evidence of previous tsunamis that have come in. And so this is a real concern for anybody who lives near the, down near the Puget Sound level there, but also just the whole infrastructure. Boeing, for example, is right at sea level there. Interstate 5, and so there's a whole concern about what would happen just to the whole infrastructure of that area there. So people are taking this seriously now, developing contingency plans, things like that. But it's a big concern there. Volcanoes are another one. The eruptions themselves are a concern, but even more concern than the actual eruptions are what are called lahars. Lahars are mud flows or debris flows, and they happen when lava or hot ash erupts on snow and ice. And they create a very, very volatile mixture that comes roaring down the mountainside, usually about 100 miles an hour. And there's no way you can outrun it here. And what we're seeing, what geologists have found now, is all these yellow areas here are historic lahar flows that come off of Mount Rainier. And that's why I say, you know, this, if you begin to look at, there's, you know, Tacoma and Federal Way and Puyallup, and some of our major cities in there sit right in the pathway of these lahars in previous times there. Mount Rainier still has lots and lots of glaciers on it, still geologically active as far as we know. We don't know if or when it will erupt again, but it's a real risk on that. So geologists are creating these geological hazard maps to help us be able to anticipate them and do planning along the line of that here. This is just a kind of a fun thing from Mount Baker to the north of the Lassen Peak. As you can sort of see, like Mount Jefferson, pretty good evidence it's probably extinct. We haven't had any kind of eruption there. But virtually every other one, here's Mount Rainier, right? 2,000 years ago, Mount Rainier has had a lot of eruptions. Mount St. Helens, of course, we're very familiar with that. Mount Shasta, pretty steady all the way along the way there. Mount Baker, when I was studying geology, people told me Mount Baker was extinct. Extinct volcano. We now know it's not. So we're in a very geologically active zone here, and I'd be thinking about that. But, the other one, I would put climate change as a geological hazard as well. A lot of our precipitation weather patterns are actually shaped by the geology. So the fact that we have the Pacific coast is so wet is because the North Cascades block a lot of moisture that falls on that side. And then you have Eastern Washington is much more dry, and the rain shot all that. But a lot of geology really shapes a lot of our weather patterns here. And as climate change is making our summers hotter and drier, we're getting more and more drought. So many of the different features there are on the flip side of that. So we have fire-adapted forest systems that have grown during a wetter period. And we're now moving into a hotter, drier period. So here's an outline of the Wolverine Fire, Donkey Lake here, Holden Village here. But this is another hazard we just had to kind of deal with here. Particularly because as I move to the last thing, which is the blessings of our geology here, we're extremely fortunate that the North Cascades hold water and ice. And this area could be much, much drier than it is, but we have a year-round water source because of the snow and ice, and the ice cap in there. As the glaciers begin to disappear, we're not going to be able to take this for granted in the same way. So it's a real concern. So this is a blessing we've had for a number of years, but can't take it. It's changing now. So hydroelectric power. I mean, dams are controversial. We're going to see a really exciting film with David Christian about taking one out of the Elwha River there. But even regardless of that, the area here, Pacific Northwest would not be nearly as developed as it is without the hydroelectric energy that has been provided by the Columbia River system, several others there. So, you know, we have to figure out how to do this better, but it's been a huge factor in the development. I think Martin will be talking about that as well in the Columbia River on that. Very, very fertile soils. If any of you have driven across the Palouse region of sort of southeast there, these are all glacial soils here. These are the winds that came in front of the glaciers, picked up a lot of the dust, which was very fertile, deposited there. If you're in that area, you know, one of the things really interesting about the Palouse is you see all these rocks, these boulders sticking up through it. That area prior to the glaciers would have looked like a moonscape. It was just all basalt areas there. The glaciers came along, and the winds picked up all this. The glaciers, this is very, very fine ground dust that the glaciers have grind up as they go along, picks up the wind and then filled in a lot of these valleys. And it's one of the reasons you have to be very concerned about loss of soil in the Palouse, because it's not all that deep in a lot of places, and once it's gone, we're going to need a continental glacier to get it back. But this is a blessing. You have these really fertile soils that have been provided, and you mix volcanic ash with that, being downwind from Mount Adams, so forth, you've got a lot. And then a lot of us choose to live here because of the geology. What geology has produced. We live in an extraordinary, beautiful place. Places like Leavenworth, Cloudy Pass, and Mount Shuckson, these different areas here. What's the pass above us, east of Egan? Up on Marble? Anyway, Cascade Pass. This is Cascade Pass here, I think. That's geology has produced a landscape that many of us find compelling and want to live in here. So that's what I have in terms of a very quick overview. Tom, how do I do in terms of words for tuition dollars?